This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Are you ready to discover your True North Story with your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerall?
So excited to get a chance to talk to you. This is an interesting story. Tam and I are childhood friends. We grew up together as youngsters, I mean, single digits in Chicago. And then her family moved to Arizona, and I stayed in Chicago. And then I, after college, went to Atlanta. And so 20 years later, fast forward, we reconnected, and we both had degrees in broadcast journalism, and we were both involved in media. And I teach storytelling and content strategy at UW here in Seattle. And we just got back together and thought, how is there a way we could work together? And so True North Story became the byproduct of that, which was to take really interesting, eclectic individuals and find out what influences and guiding forces, if you want to call it, played a role in their lives and played a role in them becoming who they are today, whether it's artists, performers, musicians, songwriters, scientists, artists like yourself.
We found that everybody has a life journey, and obviously yours was in flying for a while, and you've,
all
you've
kinds, discovered yeah, motherhood and
motherhood and music, crafting and arts. You found this amazing journey leading you to where you are today. And you know what? We're still on that journey, and we have more to discover.
It never ends. I tell my daughters that all the time. I'm just like, you may as well. I mean, you're never, ever going to, like, reach that point where you're like, okay.
You know, right.
I mean, it just keeps on going, and it keeps on going, and, you know, it's just this ever-evolving. But I can say that my needlepoint that I do has been with me from the very beginning. Through every single solitary incarnation, that's been the thread that has run, or the yarn that has run
wow.
through it all. It's kind of kept me who I am, I guess. It's my little addiction that I finally figured out a way to make as my career.
So, Leanna, who taught you needlepoint? Because my grandmother, that was one of her favorite handcrafts, and that's something I think that's passed down. Who taught you?
Yeah, my mother taught me. My mother was just superior at buying needlepoint canvases and doing a little bit of it and then putting it down. And when I was about eight or so, I asked her if she would show me how to do it. And she showed me how, and it was reasonably easy. And then she went and bought me a little tiny needlepoint, child-size needlepoint for me to work on, and I did it, and fast, really fast. And so she bought me a few more, and I just did them really fast, and I got to the point where I would pick hers up, and I would say, you know, I'm gonna work on yours, and she would just give it to me because, you know, it was something that she had lost interest in, and so I would finish hers, and hers were big, much bigger. My grandmother caught on to how much I love doing it and made an arrangement with me that she would buy me my own needlepoint canvases if I would completely finish them. And she would not buy me another one until I completely finished the one that I had started. And that
wow.
was the way it went until I left to go to college. The first few that I did were small, but I very quickly moved to bigger ones. I mean, they were small canvases with big holes, and I just blew through those. And then I was very much more interested in what my mother had laying over by her chair because it was more complicated, and the canvas was smaller, and the image was bigger, and it was more interesting to me than little teddy bears and pansies and the things things that I had done so quickly. And my grandmother picked up on it really fast. She saw that I was really interested, and I was very hyper when I was little, and I was a big talker. And I think that both my mom and my grandmother were always looking for things that would make me sit and be quiet, and this was perfect. This just fell right into everybody's lap.
At some point, Leanna, did you start creating your own patterns?
I didn't until, well, when I graduated from high school, I had gotten accepted to Auburn University, and I wanted to go to summer school. I wanted to leave immediately. And I had finished my needlepoint that I had been working on, and I mentioned buying another one to my grandmother, and she said, you know, I think you don't need the distraction. I think that you probably, because I can be obsessive about it, and she said, I think you just need to go and work on school for a while, and we'll just see how that goes. So I got to Auburn, and for about a year, I really didn't needlepoint because I was busy, and I was an art major, and when you major in art, when you take a five-hour art credit,
right,
as opposed to a five-hour English credit. In English, you're in the classroom 5 hours a week, 1 hour a day. In the art department, you're in class 10 hours a week, which is 2 hours a day, and that's just in class. That doesn't include everything that you have to do to get your projects and assignments done.
Completed,
and
yeah.
So it took up a lot of time. But as I got further into, probably by my halfway through my sophomore year or maybe early into my junior year, I really was wanting to needlepoint. And I had needlepointed some in the summers. That grounded me and it kept me organized and I just missed it. And so I started designing my own because I didn't have a car and I couldn't get to a needlepoint shop and I had some leftover canvas and some leftover yarn that I had got at home on a Christmas break and brought back with me, and I just started kind of designing my own. The first thing I did was an album cover in yarn, and I quickly realized that I could do these things that I never imagined I could do before.
Oh, that's awesome. What was the album cover?
It was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young so far. And, you know, it's the one that's got the little kind of doodles and drawings on
yeah.
it. It's kind of mostly white with a lot of fun little colors in it. And I just replicated it exactly just by looking at it. And I really did it for a friend. I actually did it for a boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
And it just worked. I couldn't believe it. So then I started doing other things that were around me. And it was really just something to sort of calm my mind and give me something to do in what little bit of free time I had.
Right.
And to sort of keep me grounded, although I didn't even think I realized that at the time. That's what I use needlepoint for.
Well, and I wanted to ask you too, Leanna, how did that process work? Taking something and to design it yourself, did you sketch it? Did you trace it? What does that look like for folks who aren't as familiar with needlepoint?
The things that I was doing back when I was at Auburn were pretty simple, and I didn't even really draw it on. I just kind of started in the middle and worked my way out, and I was very cognizant of picking things that were simple, that things that I knew that I could do. Years later, when I first ventured into needlepointing a portrait, my first inclination was to just draw it on in full detail, just as much detail as I could possibly get on the canvas so that then I could stitch it. That doesn't work because all the stitches in needlepoint go to the right, and that pulls the canvas. The more you needlepoint, the more it pulls it out of shape, and what ends up happening, what you've drawn, starts to not make a lot of sense. And I would get more caught up in what I had drawn instead of what I was actually looking at. You know, I would lay the image next to me, the photograph of the person that I was needlepointing, I would have laying next to me. As I would get into the needlepoint, it would get harder and harder to do, to follow what I had drawn. And so I learned to draw less and less and less. And as all these years have gone by, I draw very little now. And one of the things you learn when you're an art major and you're studying figure drawing and figure construction is to draw what you see. paint what you see. Look at what you're drawing. And I was not doing that in the very beginning because I was trying to follow what I had drawn on the canvas. But I learned that when I spent more attention on the image itself, I could complete it more easily than trying to draw it on first.
So how much do you think is imagination? It's like dots, you know what I mean, on a page. And then in your mind, you know what needs to be connected. I mean, obviously, it can't be trial by error because you don't want to invest that kind of time into putting something together and then go, that didn't really work. And then what do you do if that is the case? Do you undo the needle points and redo the needle point? Or
I can troubleshoot along right. the way. And I know that when an eye slants a certain way, that this is going to give me a problem. And this is the way I've solved it in the past. And I also know how small I can needlepoint a portrait. And I know how large a piece of canvas my hand can hold rolled up. And so I've gotten it down to a system that works for me. The real trial and error now for me is the background and the other things that I add to the portrait. Right now, I've become very fascinated with old 40s, 50s, and 60s jazz album covers, that sort of mid-century modern look with those funky colors that you know were so popular during that period of time, and those great designs that artists would use for those old Frank Sinatra albums and Art Blakey albums and Coleman Hawkins. And I'm in the process right now of working on a Joe Williams needlepoint, and I'm trying to incorporate that idea into the background. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation now because I post sometimes as I work, and I had finished a good part of his face and posted it, and I was getting ready to start working on some of the background, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, I hope this works, because it's not like painting. You can't just paint over it.
Right.
You know, you can't just, my favorite quote is, necessity is the mother of invention, but when it comes to stitching, sometimes you have to take it all back out again, and I don't want to have to do that. And sometimes I'll get, you know, a small piece of extra canvas and just play with colors and lay them next to the face of the image that I'm working on and see if I think I like it. But sometimes I'll get to the very end and stand back from it and go, well, I'm really glad that worked. you know, I mean, you just never know. And I do have some that, in my opinion, aren't my favorites. But ironically, it never fails. The ones that are not my favorites, I can't believe the people who say, oh my gosh, that's my very favorite one you've ever done. And I have to hold my tongue and not say, oh my gosh, I don't even like that one.
Right.
Because they like it. They love it. And maybe they even love it for the reasons that I don't.
So to you, your palette is the yarn and your brush is the needle.
That's exactly right.
And you're using different, I'm imagining, different yarns to create texture and to create the look. What have you learned about people's features and just the human experience as you're putting this on your canvas? What have you learned about us as people?
Well, I have learned that it's all in the eyes. And I have learned that that's where you start. And that, and I used to think it was just because I was drawn to people's eyes, but I have learned that everyone is drawn to everyone's eyes. That's where you see people. You see them in their eyes, and you almost can see through their eyes and into them. And I used to think that that was just me, but I don't think that's just me anymore. I think that that's how people truly experience each other and communicate with each other, is deep into each other's eyes. Sometimes my husband will be talking to me, and he'll get up and leave the room while he's talking, and I can hardly follow the sentence that he's saying because I really get more out of it when I'm looking right at him. And I find the same to be the case with the needle points. If I get the eyes right, everything else follows right into place. If I don't get the eyes right, it doesn't make any sense at all for me to keep going. I need to fix the eyes.
You know, that's
right. And then go from there.
That's really interesting. It's like the intention.
Mm-hmm.
The eyes are the intention.
The window to the soul, someone once said.
The window to the soul. Yeah,
right.
That's exactly right. I mean, whoever said that first knew what they were saying. And I mean, it's amazing to me how much can be communicated out of the eyes. And when people talk to me about my needle points, 90% of them say something about the eyes. And there's an interesting byproduct to needle pointing that was unintentional for me, and that is that when you're doing a small area like an eye and you have to keep changing yarns, what ends up happening is I believe the eye gets a little thicker than the rest of the face, because you don't tie knots when you needle point. You pull the thread, you catch it back through the other thread because it's yarn and it's too thick. So you catch it. But in a small area like an eye, you're catching and catching and catching these pieces over and over and over again, and it builds the eye up just a little bit. And I think that even adds more to the intensity that comes out of the eyes.
That's beautiful. And how true it is.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn. Love. Listen. Live. And now, back to the program.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine.
Art imitates life. Life imitates art.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Leanna, tell us, how do you decide who and what you, like you said, now you're kind of in the 40s, 50s, 60s album covers. Do you move through phases of what you want to do, or what drives your selections?
Well, originally, when I very first got into this, my mother brought me a painted canvas that she thought looked like one of my daughters. I have three daughters. And I didn't care for it that much. I thought it was a little flat, and I thought it was a little kitschy. I don't know. There just was something about it. And also, I didn't think it looked much like the daughter that she thought it looked like. And it was expensive. Needlepoint painted canvases are expensive. They're worth every dime, because an artist has taken the time to paint them. And I definitely want people to understand that just painting needlepoint canvases is an art form. But they can be pricey, and I just felt like that's probably not where I want my mom to spend her money right now, and this isn't where I want to put my time. But I had met her in Gadsden, Alabama, which is halfway between my hometown of Rome and where I live now, which is Birmingham. And so it took me an hour to get from Gadsden back to Birmingham, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I just kept thinking, why can't I do it? Why can't I just needlepoint Sophie? I mean, I have photographs of her. I have really great photographs of her, all three of them. Why don't I just try it and see what I can do? And I got real excited about the possibility of being able to accomplish it. And so I did. I tried it, and it was good. I mean, I was surprised. And I just didn't think I could do it. And then I did the other two, and they each got better. And by the time I was working on my third one, I was thinking, how can I do this? How no one else is doing this. How can I do this as an art form? And I knew it was not with my own children. I knew I was going to have to do portraits that were high profile and recognizable. And for me, it just seemed logical to do musicians, because I'm the daughter of a musician. And I just felt like I'm a child of the 70s. I felt like, well, who doesn't want to see Jimi Hendrix in needlepoint, and who doesn't want to see Bob Dylan in needlepoint? So,
right.
Or the Beatles. So I immediately just started finding photographs, dramatic photographs of people that I liked. And my other thought was, if no one buys these and I keep them, they better be the people I like. So that
exactly.
Made sense to me to do who I liked. I also was trying to figure out ways to get exposure. And I knew juried shows were really great ways to get exposure. People love juried shows. You can make a little money if you win. There's always a reception. Lots of people come. So I thought, okay, I'll look into some juried shows in Birmingham. And I found one at the Civil Rights Institute called the Southern Roots Exhibit. And so I needlepointed Maya Angelou for this Civil Rights Institute juried show. And I entered it, and I got second place. I thought, all right, well, next year I'm going to get first place, so what can I do? So I kept thinking all year long. I was doing other needle points, but I was like, who is going to have a big impact? And I thought, Ray Charles. So I needle pointed a chair. I did the back of a chair with a Ray Charles needle point and entered it in the same exhibit a year later and won.
You got first place?
And the director of education came up to me and said, we have a proposal for you. We would like to know if you would be interested in having your own show here at the Civil Rights Institute, which was just amazing. And then he said, in jazz. And I immediately said no. I said, I don't think I can do jazz. And he said, why? And I said, that just seems like such an important subject. And I don't want to come across as somebody who thinks I know something that I don't. And I don't think I'm the right person to do this. However, I would love to do the blues because I do know the blues. And they agreed. They said, well, yes, we would let you do the blues. However, we would like for you to go speak with someone once or twice that may be able to help change your mind. So they sent me to Dr. Frank Adams, who was one of the founding members of the Alabama Jazz Heritage Band and the director at the Alabama Jazz Hall of Fame. They sent me to him to just spend some time talking to him. So I went on a Tuesday morning, and he put on an Art Blakey album and just started talking to me, 90 to nothing, about jazz music. And by the end of the 45 minutes or so that I was in his office, he converted me. I was on board.
That's awesome.
And right before I left, he said, I know you're dragging your feet about doing this, but I want you to know if you decide to do it, I'm here for you, and I'll help you any way I can. I'm almost always here on Tuesday mornings at this time, and I said, I'll be back next Tuesday. And I went every Tuesday for a really long time and took notes and just caught his enthusiasm. And I felt like he really helped me understand things about jazz music that were not just Miles Davis and John Coltrane, which was my fear, that I was going to be this girl who walked into the Civil Rights Institute trying to say I knew something about something I didn't know anything about, trying to pass myself off as something that I really wasn't. And he really, really helped me. He it's hard for me to talk about him without getting emotional because he really, really helped me. He just mentored me, and it was a great success. And not long after that, he passed away, and I've just made it my mission to just carry it forward, just to keep telling that story that he told me. And I've gotten deeper and deeper into it. It's become more of a history of America and a civil rights story, much as it is a jazz story. I mean, you can't separate the two. It's the same story.
Jazz is America's genre, isn't it?
It is. And it's a story of adversity and revival and, you know, being pushed down and then coming back up again. And it's just this story of this crazy ride that we've been on since the 1850s.
Right.
In New Orleans. And I mean, it's so inspiring to me. And to answer the original question, my intention has always been to start at the beginning and work my way out. But I do sometimes get ahead of myself and move further out than I really intend to. I mean, I started with Jelly Roll Morton and some of the true pioneers of jazz music. But then I would get really excited, and I had to jump out and do Thelonious Monk, you know, and then I would pull myself back again, you know, and then I run forward and do Ray Charles. And I really am trying to tell this story in as chronological a way as I possibly can. But there's so many important sub-stories in the story of jazz music that I get inspired by them, and then I have to needlepoint them.
I just love that you have embraced this whole American heritage and this whole music genre that was born in America. And I love that you do album covers too, Leanna. Talk to us a little bit about the music that we hear on vinyl and how that has a whole heart and love, because we do so much in digital downloads these days, and just that connection to the actual album.
First of all, the thing with downloads and even CDs and forms of music that are not albums is that the music is so compressed. And you're trying to put entirely too much information, you know, into a format that can't hold that amount of information. With an album, you just get layer after layer after layer of what the musician truly intended for you to hear. One of my favorite musicians when it comes to being an audiophile is Neil Young, because he so persnickety about the importance of hearing every single solitary layer that he worked so hard to produce, that he worked so hard to record. And that's what I want to hear. It's so sad that the turntable went away, and it's so exciting now that it's coming back, and it's so exciting that vinyl is being pressed again, because there's really great musicians out there that are, Dan Auerbach, you know, for one, that are really trying to bring back tiny, itty-bitty little details. It's so funny, if you listen to an album that you used to listen to back in the 70s, that you've now listened to first on vinyl, then on cassette tape, then on CD, and then maybe you've even downloaded a few songs that you didn't go out on and buy on CD, and then all of a sudden you go back and you listen to that album again. It's like, holy cow, who knew all this music was on this piece of vinyl? And the other thing that I feel about it is that when a musician records an album, they're telling a story. And when you're picking songs off of iTunes, you're not hearing the story that these musicians have worked diligently to tell. And I have been over the years about that with my daughters. And if they ever walk in my house and say, oh, I downloaded that, they know they're going to get a lecture about the importance of listening to an album from start to finish. I mean, I think it's in honor of the time that this musician and this recording studio and all these technicians took to tell this story, just such an important story.
Well, and it's really interesting to me, because as a huge consumer of music myself, Tam and I both, we love music, all genres, all eras. I think that's a lost art form that you just touched on. And story is getting so overused, but yet there is a talent in telling stories, whether it be musically or whether it be through needlepoint or whether it be the pen. And we live in this culture where it's like all about instant gratification and right now one thing. So it's like we got to have the one song. One song that everyone downloads, let's get a million downloads. One song gets all the airplay. And then we'll go back and we'll recreate the album after the fact. And now we've got to come up with another 9 or 10 songs or whatever. And it's usually garbage.
Whereas in the old days, that one song, if you listen to that one song, if it were even possible to listen to that one song, of course you could hear it on the radio. But then you went out and you bought the album and you heard the song before and the song after, you went, oh, well, now that song sounds completely different.
Right.
Now I understand where that song is in that whole story that was being told. And thank goodness I went and bought the album.
And you got the liner with all the lyrics.
Oh, and the artwork on the cover, the album cover.
Oh, my goodness. And my husband, who is a graphic artist, the album that changed his life as an artist, young boy, was Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, because of all the art on it. He said, that was the day. He said, I bought that album, and that was when I knew. I knew that day that I wanted to be an artist, because he said, I could not put it down. I just couldn't stop looking at it, and it makes me so sad that so many people, children, generations have gone without that, oh my gosh, that, you know, big, beautiful art. And thank goodness it's coming back.
Thank goodness is right. Well, I, you know, we lost Chris Cornell this week, and And I thought, you know, you just made me think about an album telling a story. And I might get emotional here, but his last album, Higher Truth, if you ever have a chance to listen to it from start to finish, it is one of those albums that fits exactly into what you're talking about, that tells a story.
I have it.
Oh, do you?
And
okay.
You're right. And I even was talking to some of my friends, you know, after I bought it, and I was like, yeah, I got Chris Cornell's new album. And a lot of them were like, who's that? Oh, no. How can you not know who that is? I have to pull myself back from being preachy, you know, and I have to recognize that everybody has different levels, and that's what makes us all interesting and different. But I do hear you.
And that album was really, I felt like it came from a place, like Tam and I've talked about this within Chris, that's why we were so shocked this week, because it almost was like, I think he gets it. You know what I mean? Like if you listen to the lyrics in Higher Truth, it's like, okay, because it is dark. There's a lot of stuff in there and it tells a story. And to your point, and what a tremendous talent.
Well, yeah. And this is an obvious duh statement, but the same, you know, I had the same thing, similar thing happen with David Bowie. I went out and bought Dark Star the day it was released. And I think he died 2 days later or the next day. Anyway, I'm one of those people that puts an album on and just plays it and plays it and plays it and plays it and plays it until, you know, everybody around me is like, for God's sake, can you please listen to something else? And then he died. And then I listened to it and I just almost like I could just feel myself, all the blood just drained out. And I just thought, oh my gosh, that's what he's talking about. My husband told me to quit listening to it for a while, you know, because it just was so emotional for me to realize that he was, A, giving us this last gift, and B, that he was fully aware of where he was going, what was happening. He was saying goodbye. And in the way a true artist would say goodbye, he did it, you know, with his art. Beautiful and tragic.
I am so glad that we get to do what we do with True North Story, because we get to talk to some really amazing people. And you are no exception. And I am glad to hear it restores faith in humanity that there are people out there who care enough about the history and about art and the preservation of it, whether it be in needlepoint or on vinyl or raising three daughters that are in a home that can appreciate and respect what artists contribute to the universe. And not to mention, and I just wanted to touch on this just a little bit, the civil rights part. Talk to us a little bit about that. You had done some civil rights icons, too.
I have often thought that if you're trying to make a living as an artist today in this world, if you're trying to make a living as an artist, in my opinion, I think one of the mistakes that artists make is jumping around. You know, I'm going to paint for a while, and then I'm going to make furniture for a while, and oh look, I'm really excited about getting into making glass, and now I'm going to quilt. That jumping around that we can't help. But I also think that it's important to try to establish yourself, especially today, to try to establish yourself and stay in a lane so that people can follow you, both what literally follow you and figuratively follow you, like follow what you're doing and be excited about what you're doing in that medium that they're used to you being in. And also, for me, it's the subject, which is jazz. But
right.
I got the opportunity to participate in the theatrical outfit, which is a local theater in Atlanta that just do the most phenomenal, breathtaking work I've seen in a long time. And they were doing a play about Nina Simone, and they have a gallery that is part of their theater, an upstairs gallery where they show artists' work, and it was a good fit. And being a Nina Simone fan, you know, I knew she was friends with Langston Hughes and Lorraine Hansberry. I knew that her title, you know, Young, Gifted, and Black, was a Lorraine Hansberry quote. And so I knew that there were ties. I also knew that she was very affected by Medgar Evers' murder. So I read the script, and sure enough, it was her story following, you know, right up this storyline that I was familiar with. And as I was reading it, I thought, you know, I should do Langston Hughes. I mean, why not? I'm going to have these pieces in this show, and they're coming to see this play. Why not? So I did Langston, and then I got caught up in Lorraine Hansberry, so I did her, and then I did Medgar Evers to help tell the story of Nina Simone. And I fight now the urge to continue doing civil rights icons. The thing for me is that my jazz musicians are civil rights icons.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, Dexter Gordon. I mean, these musicians are civil rights icons. And so it's become very clear to me in the last few years, but certainly in the last year, more than ever, it's become so clear to me that this is the greatest story to tell, because it's the story of the civil rights movement through the eyes of jazz musicians. And then when you go back and you go back and you go back and you go back all the way to the 1850s, you know, even the 1700s in New Orleans, and you start looking at that story, it's all one civil rights story to me.
Yeah.
It's all one story about the importance of not diminishing other races, letting people shine for who they are and let people tell the stories that they want to tell and respect them for who they are and what their struggle is and raise them up. Mm. Let's all raise each other up. And for me, I feel like telling that story through jazz music is telling the story of civil rights.
Beautifully said.
That's incredible. So tell us, Leanna, where can people find more information and purchase your artwork or
see it?
Well, right now, it's all at home, but ready to go to the Birmingham Library is where it's going next. I'm doing the theatrical outfit again in January, the Billie Holiday play. I've got some other things that I'm doing. The best way to follow me is to either follow me on Instagram, and I'm Needlepoint Faces on Instagram, or to follow me on Facebook, and I have a professional Facebook page that is LLL Needlepoint, three L's.
So when you do one portrait, that's it, right?
Now, that's not to say that I will never do Ray Charles again.
Sure.
Or do that same portrait of Ray Charles again. If someone calls me or messages me or contacts me and says, I love Ray Charles and I must have a Ray Charles needlepoint, then I work together with them. Unless they say, I trust you, I love your work, you know, you pick the photo. But usually I'll go through a series of photos and send them to them and say, I really like this one for this reason and I really like this one for this reason, you know, and I get their input and we work together and we pick the right image, we decide on the size, and then I commit, and you know, I basically, they commission me to do the piece. And then they get exactly what they want. And
oh, that's
they pay
awesome.
For exactly what they want, and they have an original piece of art, and they don't ever have to wonder if they're going to walk into someone else's house and see their piece of art.
I just have to ask, have you ever done or have you ever thought about doing Johnny Cash?
I have done Johnny Cash twice, and man, Johnny Cash fans are big time. They love their Johnny Cash. I actually had Johnny Cash on a flight.
Did you meet him?
He wasn't in good shape. He was a little tipsy.
Okay.
That's okay. He slept through most of the flight, but he was very nice, and I was excited that he was on the flight, so I kind of feel like I have a little bit of a connection.
Oh, that's
with
awesome.
Him.
Well, Johnny Cash was always, he was very human, incredibly flawed, you know, and owned those flaws, and he's an iconic, I think. My dad, you see it comes full circle with the vinyl, my dad would sit in front of his record player, turntable, and would play Johnny Cash endlessly, just listening to Johnny Cash's songs over and over.
I'm that way with Neil Young. I just play him and play him and play him and play him. And now my children, who are, you know, in their 20s, all three of them, say that if they're having a bad day or if they're starting a new art project or whatever it is that they're doing, when they're in that moment, that they reach for Neil Young because there's just something homey about him. And I'm so happy to hear them say that. I'm just so happy because, you know, they complained about it when they were little. But they're like, yeah. Why do we have to listen to that again? I'm like, he's got 40-something albums. Be quiet.
I love it.
Thank you for sharing your True North story with us. I love that you have America, Americana, music, handcraft, connection with people.
In the South and civil rights and
so much
a vision. Yeah.
So much in your story, and I'm so thankful that we have an opportunity to share your story with others.
Between shows and other things, I almost always have a commission piece going, so I love sharing my excitement over music and musicians with like-minded people, so those are usually the people that commission me.
Thank you, Leanna, so much for sharing your True North story with us.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it, and thanks for being interested in what I'm doing.
Thanks, Leanna.
All right, enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.